This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. Summer is upon us with warm, sunny weather, and the waters of the Olympic shore beckon to boaters of every stripe to come play. So this week on the Compass, we reprise a show by veteran kayaker and KPTZ DJ Chris Bricker on the subject of kayak safety, which was motivated by the tragic deaths of two kayakers off the Dungeness Spit when the weather suddenly turned bad in April of 2015. So now, let's go inside the Compass.
Originally built and used in the subarctic by the Inuit, Aleut, and Yupik tribes for hunting, kayaks have become recreationally popular over the years, both in freshwater and on the sea. Today, we'll be speaking with Chris Duff, veteran kayaker and adventurer, Dr. Sam Baker about the effects of cold water immersion, members of the Olympic Peninsula Paddling Club about preparedness, and Coast Guard rescue swimmers from Air Station Port Angeles about being out on the water in this spectacular and dynamic region. I met up with Chris Duff, well-known kayaker and adventurer, at Hollywood Beach in Port Angeles. Chris spent 7 years in the Navy as a hard hat diver, got out in 1983, and then spent a year and a half on an 8,000-mile trip around the eastern third of the U.S. and Canada. That was his introduction to sea kayaking. Since then, Chris has paddled around Ireland, Great Britain, New Zealand, South Island, and Iceland. At the time I spoke with Chris, he and his wife were preparing to leave for Ireland on a 2-month bicycle trip.
Every single time we go out, there is an opportunity to learn and to look around and to recognize, of course, the incredible beauty of the area in which we live, but also the inherent danger in the sport. We're in the Northwest where the water is cold, weather and winds can change very quickly, and they do. And so everybody's got to be prepared for those changes.
It is a great sport. How would you compare it to, say, climbing or hiking?
Well, I think what's interesting about sea kayaking, the risks aren't as obvious as they might be compared to, let's say, mountaineering. And what comes to my mind is something that my wife and I have talked about often, and that is when you're in the mountains, and we do a fair bit of backpacking and backcountry skiing, and when there's a threat, you can sit down. And you can hunker down and you can come up with a plan, or you can cover up quickly and just sit out a storm. Well, when you're on the ocean, there's no place to hide. And I think that is missed by a lot of people. They don't realize that once you are more than a quarter mile from land, you are in a very, potentially, a very dangerous environment. Swimming in these waters without a wetsuit or a dry suit is out of the question. There's no sitting out a problem, and you have to think on your feet. As the problems develop, you have to be as dynamic as that sea and weather pattern that you are involved in.
Let's talk a little bit about what you think would be good preparedness for going out in this environment.
I think the best piece of advice I could give anybody getting into the sport is get in this water with a swimsuit on and see if you can tread water for 5 minutes. That doesn't sound like it's very hard to do, but if we got into this water today with just a swimsuit, A, it would take your breath away immediately. There'd be a gasp reflex. It's terribly cold. I don't want to say don't take up sea kayaking. That's not my story at all. I want to introduce as many people as I can to the sport. But I want everybody to understand that this is a sport that is extremely dangerous. Potentially extremely dangerous.
And keeping that in mind, Chris, that means that preparation is important and skills training is important.
Absolutely.
Being affiliated with a group that really knows what it's doing in terms of preparation and planning.
Yeah, I think that's the best, another piece of very sound advice to give newcomers, and that is to get involved with a local paddling group who are safety conscious. We've got a tremendous group here in Port Angeles, the Olympic Peninsula Paddlers, and they're very safety conscious, and they're just a solid group of people who rent the pool on a regular basis. You can go to the pool, you can develop rescue skills, rolling skills, and you can do it with people who are then with you on the open water. So there's a real familiarity to who your team members are.
The accident that happened not too long ago, what were some of the avoidable things that you think could have happened in preparation and execution of the whole trip?
Well, the biggest thing that they missed, it's hard to believe that they did miss it, was the weather report. It was a cold front that had been forecast 1 week in advance. The Straits of Juan de Fuca act like a funnel with the westerly winds, and somehow, maybe they listened to the weather report, but they didn't understand what consistent 25 knot wind will do to a sea. So that was their biggest mistake. Coupled with that is that they weren't dressed for immersion. And that is a horrible mistake. And that is why two people died. They didn't have wetsuits or dry suits on. I understand two of the group of seven did, but those who died did not. So at the very start, those were two gross errors that they made. And then group dynamics. Why did the group get split up? I believe it was because they were just inexperienced. And in a high wind, it's very hard to keep a group together. A well-orchestrated group who know the abilities of everybody within that group, it's not impossible to hold a group together in those sorts of winds, but it takes discipline, it takes experience.
So leadership would be a key here.
Absolutely, absolutely. Somebody in every single group has to take that role, and so that when there is a problem, the other members of the group know who to turn to for direction. And then it's not only the leader who has a primary role. Everybody in that group has a role on some level. Sometimes it's just a matter of, if I tell you to do this, you must do that. Do we agree upon that? Something as simple as that. Because as soon as that starts to break down, the group starts to split up, and then the leader, no matter how good he or she is, you cannot be in more than one spot at one time. And if the group is starting to splinter and get blown this way and that way with wind, and then couple that with tidal condition, that leader can only do so much.
Being prepared in skills training, what would be the difference between learning how to do a wet exit out of a kayak in a pool as opposed to doing one in an environment where this is something that either happens either accidentally or intentionally in order to survive?
Well, the pool is the obvious place to start, but it can't stop there. And unfortunately, some people will say, well, I've got a role. You know, I can do it in the pool, you know, 80% of the time. Well, that 80% of the time consistency in the swimming pool is probably down to about 10% of the time in the open ocean. And when I say open ocean, let's just say the Straits. This is 48 degree water. You may be able to do the roll and the rescue and the wet exit in the pool, but when you hit that cold, cold water, it has a startling effect on you. So if you're going to practice in the pool, wonderful. And then transition from the pool into a calm, controlled environment on the open water. And then gradually move from that calm, controlled scenario out into perhaps a small tide race. And then purposely go out, and this is all with the assumption that you're under the leadership of a good, solid group that can provide a parameter of safety. Ultimately, you want to be able to go out on a windy, challenging day and do a roll, and then do a rescue, and then help out with a rescue. So it's got to be a progressive learning curve, and it can't stop.
What you're talking about is acquiring a certain amount of confidence, and with that comes the ability to stay cool, to stay calm.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. If you don't have that experience, then the first time it happens out on the open water, you're going to be severely handicapped because you don't know your own fear level if you've never been in that environment. But if you've gradually moved into that more challenging environment, you know what the fear feels like, and you know that, okay, I can get through this because I've done it. I've done it a half dozen times. So this is no longer an alien environment. I can do this because I've done it before. I can help this person out. I can get them back in their boat because, by golly, wasn't this what we practiced last month? That sort of thing.
Before we wrap it up, I think you might have a couple of personal stories.
Well, one that comes to mind is when I was circumnavigating New Zealand. I was almost blown offshore, and it was an incredibly violent wind. and it came out of the Southern Alps. So it's a cold glacial mass of air that was coming out of the mountains and hitting the water and fanning out at something 40 knots of wind or somewhere in that range. And it was absolutely terrifying. There's no better way to describe it. And I was also, because of my previous experience, I was able to focus and just put all of my energies into driving the boat into the wind and back to the protection of the cliffs. I was scared to death, and I was afraid of dying. And every time I go out, you know, here we are sitting on the beach, and I look at that water, it is steely gray, and I know that it is deadly cold, and it will kill me just as quickly as it will kill anybody else who is ill-prepared. And if I make the mistake of going out without a wetsuit or a dry suit, or if I haven't checked the winds, I am no more able to survive than the next person. You know, if I break the rules, the consequences are severe. And I want to counter that with, it is an incredible environment that feeds my soul. And, you know, there are whales and seals and sea otters. And, you know, it's a wonderful, beautiful environment. But we have to respect it. Even when you're having the best day in your life, you have to be aware that, okay, what's that cloud formation telling me? What's that new puff of wind on the side of my face? Something's changing here. Pay attention. You know, pay attention.
Squim, Washington lies in the rain shadow of the Olympic Mountains. It was there I met with Dr. Sam Baker, a retired orthopedic physician and experienced kayaker. Cold water immersion has been his specific area of interest, and he does presentations about the subject to groups around the peninsula.
I started kayaking in the 1960s and I didn't really know any of the safety precautions. I used to just paddle in regular clothes, no PFD, no spray skirt, so I'm pretty fortunate to still be around. With the experiences we've had, my wife and I now paddle in good sea kayaks with spray skirts, dry suits, and equally important, PFD, which is a personal flotation device.
Why is that so important?
Well, because if you talk about cold water immersion, which occurs here in these waters with the temperatures between 45 and 50 degrees, there's actually four phases of cold water immersion. And in those phases, if you are not wearing a PFD and you're not dressed appropriately, your survival time will be less than half an hour. Whereas with the PFD on helping you stay afloat and keeping your face out of the water, that will extend that survival time.
What do you think is the most common misconception that people have about getting into a kayak as a recreational activity?
Well, I think there's several misconceptions. The most common one will be that I can swim, therefore I don't need a PFD, or that I'm close to shore, so I can swim to shore, or I can put my PFD on in the water. 90% of the people who drown are not wearing a PFD, and almost half those people are less than 6 feet from safety.
So what happens? Give me a scenario.
A scenario would be somebody who's paddling in regular clothes on a sunny day, and they have no PFD on, and they suddenly capsize, and all of a sudden they're hit with what is called cold shock. It's an automatic reflex where you gasp and you can suck in water into your lungs and drown immediately. It only takes 5 ounces of water for that to occur. Also, with that gasp reflex and water on your vocal cords, you can't call for help or you can't breathe very well. Also, there's a sudden increase in your respiratory rate. And just like in a doctor's office, if you don't like needles, you start to hyperventilate and you faint. And of course, if you faint in water without a PFD, you're gonna drown. And also it causes muscle spasm. And so with that, you're not able to swim or control yourself. You drowned. And also with the cold shock response, there's a sudden increase in adrenaline output. This increases your blood pressure, heart rate, stresses the heart, and you can have a heart arrhythmia and have a cardiac arrest. This is more common in older people.
So it's not just what people would ordinarily assume to be hypothermia as the culprit. How long in the water would it take for a person to become hypothermic?
Well, that's an interesting question, because if you take a poll of a lot of people, about 90% of them will say that you become hypothermic in the first 5 or 10 minutes. But in actual fact, if with regular clothes on and cold water being in the 30 degrees, for example, hypothermia does not occur for about a half an hour. And hypothermia is defined as a core temperature or body temperature of 95 degrees. So it takes a long time to become hypothermic. Hypothermia is just one of four stages of cold water immersion. It's actually the third stage. The second stage of cold water immersion after cold shock is called cold incapacitation. And that occurs in the first 10 minutes or so in water, for example, that's 45 or 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Because the cold water makes the blood vessels constrict in your arms and legs, and the nerve response and muscle response slows down, so you all of a sudden you become clumsy, weak. You can't manage a radio, can't put on a PFD, you can't get up on your boat, and so you really get muscle incapacitation, and it will only get worse. It won't get better. And also, if you try to swim, you lose more and more body heat, and so your incapacitation gets worse, not better. And so, if you're not wearing a PFD, you basically will not survive that first half hour to get to the stage of hypothermia, and that's been shown pretty clearly. Your time to unconsciousness in the water around here, dressed in regular clothes, is about an hour. And if you're alone, at least try to get up on your boat out of the water, because you lose heat, body heat in the water about 25 times as fast as in the air of the same temperature. So it becomes critical to try to get out of the water. So the other things that are important are what kind of rescue equipment you have, flares or radio. You should always have some way of communication, like a VHF radio, and much better than a cell phone. Cell phones work well when they work, but if they don't, then that is a problem.
So Sam, just for those out there that may not know the difference between a dry suit and a wetsuit, can you briefly describe the two and the differences?
A wetsuit would be neoprene of various thicknesses. It's called a wetsuit because water gets between the suit and your skin, and your body warms up that water so that you have a warm layer between yourself and the wetsuit. In a dry suit, it's usually made of Gore-Tex. No water comes into that suit. You wear some type of thermal underwear lining underneath that, various thicknesses depending on the temperature of the water. And so your body is dry, undergarments under the dry suit are dry, and the dry suit keeps you dry.
Any final thoughts, Sam, about kayaking in these beautiful waters up here?
Prepare for the worst and hope for the best. Leave information with people on shore, where you're going, when you're coming back. Learn skills, practice skills, and just look at being safe as your prime responsibility on the water.
17 miles west of Port Angeles along US 101 is a deep water lake located entirely within Olympic National Park, Lake Crescent. There, I met with members of the Olympic Peninsula Paddling Club. They were about to conduct a monthly skills training session. The club's membership ranges from people just beginning in the sport to experts in Greenland-style rowing and surf kayaking, and from members looking to purchase their first boat to those who have built their own kayak. I had a conversation with three of the founding members about kayaking in the Northwest and the importance of training.
I'm Mike Stanhope. I'm the current president of the club. I've been kayaking for about 11 years, so I came up here knowing absolutely nothing about it to where I am today, which is maybe an intermediate paddler.
My name is Cecil Oxford. I live in Squim, paddling since 1969, canoes and kayaks. I have lived in the Northwest since 2005.
Jim Benson, and I have lived out here about 35 plus years. Moved out here from Wisconsin where I did some canoeing. I've been into kayaking out here since about 1995.
Not too long ago, there was a tragic accident that happened out there around the Dungeness Spit. What does that say to you, Michael, in terms of your degree of awareness and some of the takeaways that you have from such a tragic accident?
Well, I would say two things. Number one, one of the survivors was quoted as saying, "We took a lot of precautions, but unfortunately, it wasn't enough." And I would say we do the same thing, and we certainly take more than they took. But in reviewing what happened, we recognize that there are more precautions we could take, too.
Like what? What comes to mind?
Well, biggest thing is bringing the level of knowledge and skill among the membership in general to as high a level as possible, rather than having the membership at large depend on four or five people that have a level of experience and they just kind of tag along. We want to bring them up to as high a level as they're capable.
Cecil, let's start with a group dynamic. What do you think are some of the main things to consider in terms of somebody paddling in a group?
I think there's some complacency that you can find in members of a group because they are in a group and they may not carry their radio because somebody in the group has a radio. So one of the things that this incident brought to my attention was the fact that we have a group of members that we paddle weekly, year round. So we have some complacency in that group in that we don't always say, okay, this is what we're going to do today. This person's in the lead. How are we going to raft up or form up if we have an emergency? We're not really prepared as we think we are, and we need to kick that up a notch. So that's what we've been trying to do since then.
That's good. In fact, right now here at Crescent Lake, this is what they call skills training practice. So there are a number of paddling clubs members that are out here just for that purpose. Jim, I would like you to speak to what the qualities are of a group leader.
Well, I think a group leader basically wants to be all-inclusive and including everybody in the paddle in preparedness to make sure everyone takes the responsibility to check the conditions before they show, to be sure you're aware of tides, currents, and just to be aware, even on a very benign day such as Dungeness can be, that the one thing that you can count on is things are going to change. And that 5-knot wind can turn into a 25-knot wind, so just being aware of changes. And when you paddle together with people, everybody gets pretty well aware of signaling and things that the general communication involves. So just being able to communicate and stay together.
Port Angeles Harbor is protected by a 3.5-mile long spit called Edith's Hook. Since 1946, there's a beacon positioned atop the control tower of the Coast Guard Air Station near the end of the hook. At the station, I met with Aviation Survival Chief Scott Rady, with a 24-year career under his belt, and Aviation Survival Technician Second Class Nathan Newberg, who has been stationed at Port Angeles for 3 years of his 8-year career. Both men, highly conditioned and professional, met with me for a conversation about safety and survival in these waters.
When you have an alert, how long does it take you to be airborne?
Usually we're airborne within 20 minutes of getting the call, and most of the time we're faster than that.
Most of the time, do you have the coordinates, or are there times where you really need to actually go out and search a whole grid?
Really varies by reporting source and the channels that they take. Sometimes we have a lot of detailed information and we fly right there and it's exactly what they told us. Sometimes we fly there and get turned around and people that reported it are confused or something and we have to go to a completely different area, so we see everything.
Situations that you've encountered where you would like to see maybe more skills, better training, what are your feelings about small crafts?
From my perspective, the thing to remember with like small boats and kayaks and canoes and things like that is there aren't as many rules that people are going to be checking for when you go out. Like if you have a larger boat, like a motor boat, the Coast Guard can do a boarding on you and they're going to look for safety equipment and make sure that everything is up to date and nothing's expired. But they don't have that kind of inspection type stuff with kayaks and canoes and smaller boats. So the thing to remember is that the area around here, it might be sunny and warm, but the water is cold all year long. So taking the precautions to be safe and prepared if you happen to go in the water, which is a higher likelihood on a smaller boat, is definitely something to think about when you're getting ready to take out that small boat. Right around here, the water temperature, it only gets up right above 50 degrees, so it's cold year-round. So definitely like a safe kayaker out here in the Sound and in the Strait is someone that's wearing a dry suit, that has a PFD on, and that has a way to communicate if they get into trouble.
How often do you encounter sort of a lack of preparedness in the people you see out on the water?
Flying around, we see all kinds of different stuff. I mean, we see people that are headed out to the open ocean and they're prepared with gear that's going to last them on a trip down to California on a kayak. They're prepared with dry suits, EPIRBs, radios, all the insulative gear that they need should they get into the water. And then we also see the people that are just here for the tourist season that think it'll be fun to take out a small boat for the day, and they're out there in shorts and a t-shirt, not thinking that they might go in the water or it's even a possibility.
Now, for our listeners out there, an EPIRB?
An EPIRB is an emergency locating device. You push a button and it broadcasts your GPS signal. The Air Force tracks them. They work on land and in the water as well.
As a rescuer, your object is to get out there and save lives. What's your takeaway in terms of some of the things that you've seen and the effort that you may have put into a rescue and then having it compromised by lack of preparedness? What are your personal feelings about that?
I would say the experience level, getting trained on how to paddle, signaling devices. Obviously, we've talked about, you know, wearing the right equipment, the right thermal protection, the right PFDs, you know, using a spray skirt on your boat. So where you start getting water in your boat, your feet, you know, now you're starting to get cold. You don't realize it. You're exerting a lot of energy while you're paddling, so you're getting warm. You know, people like to shed clothing when they get warm, and they don't realize that, you know, once you fall in the water, it's hard to put that clothing back on. You got to think about, if I go out here today on this day kayak, there is a possibility of me being out here at night. So do I need to bring, even though I plan on going for the day, I will need some way to signal somebody at night via a flare or a strobe light. I think a strobe light's probably the smallest, easiest thing you could carry. And, you know, with our night vision goggles, I mean, you can see that from miles away. If anything keys us off to something that's in trouble, it's a strobe light. Of course, the equipment, but you know, the big thing is the planning, letting somebody know where you're going, having a float plan, like we like to call it, and just the experience level.
Young Sea by Carl Sandburg. They love the sea, men who ride on it and know they will die under the salt of it. Let only the young come, says the sea. Let them kiss my face and hear me. I am the last word, and I tell where storms and stars come from. You've been listening to a special presentation for KPTZ Compass.
This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Chris Bricker and edited by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. and repeats the following Saturday at noon. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ Live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, this is Compass Executive Producer Steve Evans.